In the early morning hours of Saturday, October 2, 2004, Sydney, a country and western singer, was driving home from work on a rural road in Bristol, Tennessee, when he noticed what appeared to be a fire between the trees some distance away. As he drove, reported MUFON Tennessee State Section Director Kim Schaffer, he again noticed the fire, which seemed somewhat brighter and appeared to be moving. He neared an intersection near his home and exited his car, for a better look. Slowly, from behind trees, emerged a huge triangle-shaped craft. The witness started to run but realized there was nowhere to run to, so he stood in awe and watched. The craft slowly came into full view, a perfect triangle which the witness estimated to be some 300 feet in length and width, and only 100 feet or so high, blocking out all the sky. He noted three large domes, comparing each dome to twice the size of his car, burning brilliantly a reddish orange, lighting the treetops and illuminating the entire bottom of the craft. He also noted rib-like structures evenly spaced and running the width of the craft. See photo section. As the object passed over the witness's head, he stated that his skin burned, tingled, and felt really strange. He also noted that the sound seemed to permeate throughout his body and, being a professional musician, assured me that he could never adequately reproduce the throbbing hum he heard. The object passed over the witness, made a westward turn without banking, and was gone from his sight. The witness went home and tried to sleep but could not get the object off his mind. He had managed to get some sleep early that morning and awoke to a nosebleed, a metallic taste in his mouth, and his skin feeling sunburned on his back and face. He also noted that when he brushed his hair, strands of it were coming out in the brush. He also has been weak and nauseated since this encounter. 29. I asked Kim Schaffer for his evaluation of the case. He is a devout Christian and would not dare to elaborate anything which took place that early morning, he responded. Sydney had lost 15 minutes on his electric watch. He has monitored it closely, with the same battery, since and it has lost no time whatsoever. He has also been having recurring nightmares and been awakened several times by beams of light coming in his bedroom and strange noises, humming and buzzing, outside. I might add that he was diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor, very small, 3 millimeters, in his frontal lobe just prior to the encounter. Subsequent medical tests, MRI and ultrasound, revealed the tumor was gone. I think this was sometime in January 2005. I am shocked as well by the extreme interest shown by Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and the US government to the report on the website immediately after the encounter. As webmaster, I am able to see the domains which visit the site. There were hundreds of visits from the aforementioned domains, which have never visited before or since. 30. Cambridge, UK, why don't UFOs appear over major cities? I am frequently asked. To which my response is that they have done so, on numerous occasions, such as over Aberdeen in 1956 and Phoenix in 1997. Cambridge may not be a major city in terms of size, but for centuries it has remained one of the world's leading centers of academic excellence. In his column in The Independent on Sunday in December 2004, journalist Andy Martin reported that while cycling back from a concert on a Friday night in Newton Road, Cambridge, he neglects to give a date. For a couple of hundred yards he had a clear view of a trio of radiant white lights in the sky, garnered with a few blinking blue and red lights underneath them. What I couldn't work out was what they were doing there. I was pedaling while they remained perfectly still. Obviously, they were nothing to do with an aeroplane. As I approached the end of Newton Road, where I live, I got off my bike and I was looking, slack-jawed, almost straight up. Had the guiding star turned up early? In fact, it was more of a starship, the bright lights just hanging there in the sky, I would estimate at a height of around 400 or 500 feet. There was no noise, not a whisper. As I looked more closely, I could see the dark outline of a craft that was nothing like a plane. There was no central tube and a couple of wings poking out at the sides. It was more rounded or at least bulkier. But it was big, definitely jumbo-sized. and it wasn't going up and it wasn't coming down. It was going neither right nor left. A couple of minutes passed by in which nothing, except for this great miraculous nothing in the sky, happened. Then, smoothly, gently, quietly, the UFO, for it was certainly unidentified and it was a flying object, tired of immobility and pulled away from its parking spot, picking up speed as it went over my head and over the house in the rough direction of Girton. There was a faint rumble, a kind of deep purring noise, as it went by. The way it moved had a silky, dancing quality. I raced around into the back garden, but it had already vanished. I should add, by way of confirmation, that my wife and 14-year-old son, who had been playing in the concert, were with me at the time. I said to them, "Was that a UFO?" "Yes," said my son. "Is there any chocolate going?" For at least 24 hours I was mentally paralyzed by the conviction that there is, indeed, extraterrestrial life, and some of it had been visiting Cambridge. Saturday night found me telling an old friend about my ET experience. A blonde woman at a neighboring table leaned over and apologized for butting into our conversation, but she couldn't help overhearing. She told us that there is an experimental aircraft facility at Basingbourne, only a few miles away as the UFO flies, probably run by the Americans. 31. She had heard that they were experimenting precisely with noise reduction and they tended to fly at night, to keep things hush-hush. But even she had to admit, was uncertain about the ability of an extremely large object to anchor itself in the sky for long periods. 32. My attempts at communicating with Andy Martin to learn more unfortunately drew a blank. Of related interest, another journalist had an encounter that month. Ian Murray, editor of the Southern Daily Echo, was driving along the A31 road toward Ringwood, Hampshire, on December 7th. When at about 16:30 traffic slowed down to watch a strange craft as it passed overhead. Hovering above us was a triangular-shaped aircraft with a spotlight, Murray describes. It was slow enough to be a helicopter but dissimilar. I mentioned it to the news desk here at the paper. But, I was informed by colleagues barely concealing their smirks, checks with Southampton Airport and Hampshire Police brought no reports of strange aircraft that late afternoon. 33. The Channel Islands, located in the English Channel between the south coast of the United Kingdom and northern France. The Channel Islands are an archipelago of British Crown dependencies. In the spring of 2007, two airliners encountered two huge craft of unknown origin. The report was first published as a front-page exclusive in the Guernsey Press and Star on April 26, but the story made more of an impact 2 months later, following publication of an official report by the Civil Aviation Authority, CAA, confirming the incident. On April 23, 2007, Captain Ray Bauer was flying an 18-seat, three-engine Britain Norman BN-28 Drillander of Orkney Air Services from Southampton to Alderney, with passengers on board. The flight deck on this aircraft is not separated from the passengers. At 4,000 feet, visibility was very good for 100 miles, with low-level haze up to 2,000 feet, Bauer reported. He first spotted a brilliant yellow light which he thought was about 5 or 6 miles away, but changed his mind after another 20 miles, as the object still seemed at a distance. I reached for my binoculars while flying on autopilot, he reports in Leslie Keane's book UFOs, and, viewing it magnified 10 times, found that this light-emitting object had a definite shape, that of a thin cigar, sharply defined, and pointed on both ends. The aspect ratio was approximately 15 to 1 and I could clearly see a dark band two-thirds of the way along from left to right. As I drew nearer to the object, a second identical shape appeared beyond the first. Both objects were of a flattened disc shape with the same dark area to the right side. They were brilliant yellow with light emanating from them. I passed the information to Jersey Air Traffic Control, ATC, and they initially said they had no contact. I pressed the point over the next few miles and the controller at Jersey, Paul Kelly, then said he had primary contacts south of Alderney. At this point, the passengers began to notice the unusual things and to ask about them. I decided not to make any announcement over the intercom so as not to alarm anyone, but it was obvious that some were getting concerned. By now the two identical objects were easily visible without binoculars. ATC then informed me that there were two reflections from primary radar, both to the southwest of Alderney. This was beyond my destination, for which I was glad as the objects were becoming uncomfortably close. Their brilliance is difficult to describe. They both seemed to be stationary, but the radar traces proved otherwise. They were actually moving away from each other at about 6 knots. Approaching the point to begin descent, 20 miles north-northeast of Alderney, I maintained an altitude of 4,000 feet to remain in good view of the objects. If they started to move off, I wanted to be able to take action to avoid them if at all possible. Due to my close proximity, the dark area on the right of the nearest one took on a different appearance at the boundary between the brilliant yellow and the dark vertical band. There appeared to be a pulsating boundary layer between the two differences in color, some sort of interface with sparkling blues, greens, and other hues strobing up and down about once every second or so. The safety of the passengers is paramount, and, so to land was the priority. If the aircraft had been empty, I would have gone a lot closer, perhaps overflown the nearer object to gather further information and satisfy my curiosity. On landing, Captain Bauer asked if any of the passengers had seen anything unusual and, should they want to report it, to leave their name and number at the check-in desk. At least 6 passengers saw the objects, 2 of whom, Kate and John Russell, went public. Bauer's official report, together with a sketch of one object, was sent to Jersey ATC and to the Ministry of Defence and the car. While in Alderney, he received confirmation for the radar traces, from which he deduced that he had been about 55 miles away from the first object. It was at this point, he said, that its massive size became clear, and I estimated it to be up to a mile long. While inbound to Jersey from the Isle of Man, Captain Patrick Patterson, piloting a beige jetstream of Blue Islands Airways, witnessed one of the objects, matching Captain Bauer's description. 34. My several communications with Captain Bauer reinforced a conviction in the validity of this remarkable encounter. In an interview with an American reporter in 2011, Nick Pope, former head of the UK Ministry of Defence, MOD, UFO project, commented on the Channel Islands incident, which was included in the release of about 9,000 declassified pages of MOD documents dating from 1985 to 2007. The pilot and several of his passengers saw a UFO, which they said was essentially a mile long. And several other pilots saw it, but said, "We're not going to report this. And here's the great little get-out-of-jail-free card for the MOD." Just by a matter of maybe a few hundred meters, it turned out that this was in French airspace, so MOD was given this little get-out to say, "Well, it happened in French airspace, so it's not an issue for us." Clearly, that was an absolutely outrageous abrogation of responsibility. 35. Stephenville, Texas. Steve Allen and 2 friends were in their hometown of Stephenville on the evening of January 8, 2008, when they noticed flashing lights about 3,500 feet above ground level. The ship wasn't really visible and was totally silent, but the lights spanned about a mile long and a half mile wide, Allen told Angelia Joyner of the Stephenville Empire Tribune, a first-rate journalist with whom I have discussed the case in person. The lights went from corner to corner. It was directly above Highway 67 traveling towards Stephenville at a high rate of speed, about 3,000 miles per hour is what I could estimate. As they watched, the lights reconfigured themselves from a single horizontal line into 2 sets of vertical lights, about a quarter of a mile apart. Then they turned into what looked like white flames. Some kind of fireball, perhaps? This was discounted when about 10 minutes later the object or objects returned and flew overhead. 2 military jets, possibly F-16s, were in pursuit, said Allen, a private pilot, 36, who later appeared on CNN's Larry King live show, together with others. Major Carl Lewis, a spokesman for the 301st Fighter Wing at the Joint Reserve Base Naval Air Station, Fort Worth, denied that F-16s or any other aircraft were in the area on the night of January 8.37 later that month. However, he admitted that 10 F-16s had been in the area at the time on training missions, and eventually the Mutual UFO Network was able successfully to requisition the relevant radar data. One afternoon in early January, prior to any publicity about the sightings, Ricky Sorrells, a machinist, was hunting on his 16-acre property, 3 miles outside of Dublin, Texas, about 10 miles from Stephenville, where he lives with his wife and children. While easing through a stand of trees some distance behind his home, he casually glanced upward, continued on, then froze in his tracks. "I took a step or two, and then I realized what my eyes had seen," he told journalist Ronald Rodridge. "I look back up, and there it is. It's covered the sky, as far as you can see." Viewed through his rifle's telescopic sight, the object appeared as very large, without seams, nuts, or bolts. The only distinct characteristics were cone-like protrusions on the bottom that he surmised had something to do with keeping it airborne, and a subtle wavering in the atmosphere beneath it, like heat rising off pavement in the summertime, Rodrich reported. The object lingered for a moment, and then quickly took off to the north, though it didn't seem to disturb the air when it did so. 38. Following media publicity, Sorrells came to regret having spoken about it. Sorrells believes military officials have been harassing him by flying military aircraft over his property at low altitudes, at all hours, wrote Angelia Joyner. "Not just once, but 4 times. He claims to have seen the massive flying object he estimates to be the length of 3 or 4 football fields." The day after speaking with the Associated Press, Sorrells was contacted by a man who implied he was an Air Force lieutenant colonel, and whose behavior became threatening. The colonel also seemed responsible for an ensuing spate of harassment by low-flying military helicopters, often in the small hours, as well as by F-16s over Sorrells' property. 39. The Stephenville events generated worldwide media interest for many weeks, leading many researchers to believe that finally, perhaps, disclosure was just around the corner. It was not to be. Monmouth, UK, in September 2008. The historic border town of Monmouth, South East Wales, was visited by flying triangles. "One of the witnesses, Finian Handley, contacted me early in 2010 after hearing an interview on Radio Wyvern in which I discussed the incidents. Finian asked if I had known his late father, the conductor Vernon Todd Handley, who died on September 10, 2008. I was delighted to tell him that I had indeed worked with Todd in various orchestras and that, in company with my colleagues, held him in high regard for his fine musicianship and stick technique. Unlike many conductors, he was genuinely modest, devoid of superficial showmanship, and always cheerful." Finian is a taxi driver. At around 21:30 on September 26, while driving with a passenger through Whitchurch, a few miles from Monmouth, two black triangles appeared almost directly over the car, going slowly in the opposite direction, he related to me. 4 blue lights could be seen along the back of each craft. The triangles were only a meter or two apart. This seemed very strange for two craft to be so close together. The passenger also witnessed the craft, which then disappeared from view. But more was to follow, at around 2200 hours. As I came back into Monmouth, now alone, I saw 2 orbs, one above the other, hovering just above the trees in Chippenham Park, right next to the A40 dual carriageway. I continued through the traffic lights and directly past the orbs, which were only 4 lanes away from me and a few meters above the trees at most. I was so close to them as I passed them, less than 15 meters. I noticed that the bottom orb had what I can only describe as a chink or splinter of light coming out of the bottom right side, as if the orb was beginning to change shape. I pulled over, on the slip road over the River Wye that leads to Beach Road, as quickly as possible. In this short period, 10 seconds at most, they must have completely changed into black triangles, because by the time I'd got out of the car and turned to look at the orbs, there were triangles in the same spot, one beside the other. 40. They were low enough to hit with a stone, about the height of 2.5 lampposts stacked on top of each other, Finian told a local reporter. There were several lights on them, arranged symmetrically on the underside, represented by black dots in the drawing, and there were white lights on the three points of each triangle. I can't remember the exact layout of the lights on the underside except that there were at least three different colors, including white and red, and definitely a row of four blue lights along the back end. Each triangle was a bit larger than a small passenger jet. They hovered for a second over Chippenham Park, see photo section, then started to slowly move toward me but slightly to my right. Both objects were clearly identical in every way and were moving slower than 5 miles an hour, taking at least 15 seconds just to pass over the dual carriageway. They were absolutely silent and there were no other cars on the road at the time. 41. As they slowly and silently crossed the dual carriageway, they elongated slightly, Finian recounted for me. They momentarily also shimmered, as if becoming partially transparent, but literally for only a second, then they made a decisive turn away from me, about 90 degrees, and as they departed, all of the different colored lights on the underside, including the flat oval blue lights, faded to white. 42. After passing over the dual carriageway, they both turned slightly left, keeping perfect formation, now traveling toward the Kaimin, a wooded hill overlooking the Wye Valley and Monmouth. Then a few seconds later they split up, one continuing toward the Kaimin and the other departing straight up the dual carriageway, maintaining the same speed and height. 43. I saw exactly the same thing over Vyesham, above Monmouth, on the same evening, wrote one anonymous witness, the only difference being that what I saw, I believe, was earlier in the evening and the direction was slightly different. But his description of the two craft, the lights, etc., everything was eerily the same. These two objects came from a northerly direction, just below the Kaimin. But the really bizarre thing that occurred to me as they drew closer and eventually passed over my house was that they were hardly moving, traveling really slowly. 44. About a year earlier, Finian told me, he had seen similar craft in Monmouth, approximately a mile away from those observed in September 2008. As I pulled up to my sister's house around 7 or 8 p.m., he recounted, I saw two orbs descend out of the sky. I lost sight of them as I drove up to the house and parked. As I got out of the car and looked to where the orbs had been, I now saw two equilateral black triangles flying almost directly above my head, roughly the size of Big Ben, each with a central white flashing strobe. 45. Dorset, UK. Similar flying triangles were encountered by a couple in Dorset on October 23 or 24, 2008. My husband and I were overwhelmed by the sight of three roundly triangular, large objects, which moved through the sky at a low level toward us, our car, and then hovered above us on a country lane between Cowth Castle and Langton House, a holiday property bond site, on the Isle of Purbeck, Judith Ralph wrote to me. This was one weekday evening as we drove home after dinner. We were 100% sober, we both saw the same gently moving objects. We stopped the car and agreed to get out of the car to see if we could decide what the objects were, perhaps the sound of them would give us a clue, helicopter/microlight. But there was no sound. The objects were too large to be Chinese lanterns and there were three distinct colors, red, green, and white lights, on what looked like the underside of the object. They hovered for a full 2 or 3 minutes, surely an aeroplane doesn't silently hover. We watched outside the car and then felt spooked and decided to get back inside. The objects didn't move away before we did. We started the engine and my husband put his foot down and focused ahead on getting back to our holiday apartment. The objects then just faded off, away, and we couldn't see them anywhere. Afterwards, when we came home, we told my mother and one of our two friends, one of whom was a top dog in the Ministry of Defense, about our sightings but, afraid of being labeled mad, we have kept this experience to ourselves. Our mod friend said that there's a military base near to Purbeck, and it was probable that experiments being conducted there would be the explanation. We accepted this, and who are we to argue? 46, Leviathans of the skies continued to be reported around the world. With the inexorable and exponential advances in alien-derived technology, it is more than likely that quite a number of these vehicles are manufactured on Earth, yet it is hard to reconcile the majority of reports with such an assumption. Chapter 17, Exploitation. Marius Boiron, a former Royal Australian Air Force engineer, had recently returned with his wife Miriam from the New Georgia Group, part of the Solomon Islands in the Pacific Ocean, where they had acquired a beautiful island. Since they required new rental accommodation on Guadalcanal, Marius sought the assistance of his native friend Joseph, who selected a three-bedroom timber property at Cape Esperance. Marius thus became the first white man to live in that area. No dates are given from the following incidents, possibly owing to the natives' reluctance to discuss their many disturbing incidents with outsiders. All we are told in this narrative by Marius, which he wrote in 2003, is that his later investigations in the islands took place in 1996, 1997, and 2002. That night, Marius reports, "I started up the generator and sat back with Joseph and a few new friends to relax and have a beer. Later that night, when I was finding out a little bit more about the area, Joseph told me that I had to watch out for the dragon snake. They told me that it comes out of the mountains at night and flies around, and, with its piercing red eyes, has been feared for generations. It was responsible for people going missing and for killing people." A few days later, Marius was fishing with another friend, Sai Sai, when Joseph, who had been fishing, suddenly shouted for his friend's attention, pointing down to the beach. "The," he cried. "The dragon snake." As I looked down the beach, Marius continued, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. About a kilometer away, there was a very bright, luminous white object flying slowly over the water. I remember asking myself whether I was really seeing it. I called out for my wife Miriam to bring my binoculars. After focusing in on the star-like, brilliantly lit object, I noticed that it was about 60 feet around and seemed to make no noise. We watched it for a couple of minutes until it submerged itself into the sea. Joseph told me to wait about 10 minutes and I'd see it come back out again, which it did. When it came back out of the water, it was glowing twice as brightly as when it went in. We continued to watch it with my binoculars as it returned to the coast in the direction whence it had come, until it disappeared out of sight over the top of the coconut trees. Somewhat startled by this experience, we went back into the house and sat talking about this dragon snake until the early hours of the morning. They told me that if you didn't see it one night, you were quite likely to see it the next. They were right. In fact, over a seven-month period, I lost count of these sightings when they reached the 60 mark. So while we sat talking about this object, I explained the structure of the universe to Joseph and Sai Sai. I showed them my copy of a Time Life book, The Universe, with its space-type pictures, and said that these so-called dragon snakes were what white men call unidentified flying objects. They were absolutely amazed, as they had spent their whole life fearing this thing with superstition and having no real understanding of it. Yet, for that matter, I was also a little fearful. This sighting was the first of well over 60 more to follow, during which time I investigated the UFO waterfall lake base of northwest Guadalcanal and later the UFO bases of the central east coast of Malaita and central Small Malaita, also known as South Malaita or Marimasike. This first sighting, though, had completely changed my mind about the existence of extraterrestrials, and a little investigation revealed that this so-called dragon snake had been in the area for well over a century. I realistically began thinking in terms of extraterrestrials inhabiting our planet, a serious threat. Extensive investigations by Marius revealed that the aliens had displayed contemptible behavior toward the natives of Guadalcanal and Malaita. Indeed, he adds, there have been several outright abductions and murders. For example, the grandfather of a good friend of mine was incinerated by one of these UFOs around the early 1900s. Several independent sources have verified this. Countless horrific stories can be heard throughout these islands. One theory that Marius came up with was that these craft, which I classify as unidentified submergible objects, USOs seem to display an interest in the numerous wrecked Allied naval ships, such as the HMS Canberra and USS Chicago, destroyed by the Japanese Navy in World War II during the huge naval battles around Guadalcanal in late 1942 and early 1943.